This is Polling Matters. My name is Kieran Pedley. Today we're going to be discussing what happens after the election. Most agree that we are faced with a hung parliament after the vote in May, but what happens next? I'll be discussing with Rob Vance. Welcome, Rob.
Good to be back, Kieran.
And the prodigal son returns, Leo Barassi. Leo, welcome to Polling Matters.
Hello, Kieran. It's good to be back.
So let's talk about the campaign so far. I mean, there seems to be this consensus amongst the kind of people doing the projections, of which there are many, and some of the pollsters, that gradually the most likely outcome is some kind of arrangement between Labour and the SNP, whether probably not a formal coalition as we might expect, but certainly some kind of maybe confidence and supply or some kind of informal relationship. But are we being a bit hasty? Because, you know, there's still a few weeks left to go. Leo, what do you think? I mean, does that now look like the most likely outcome?
I think it does. I think the analysis now of the ranges of where the parties could fall out after the election has made it look very clear that it's extremely difficult for Cameron to be able to form a government that can command the House. The May 2015 website ran through the various options, and it seems very clear from that when you put together essentially the highest scores that the Tories, the Lib Dems, the DUP and UKIP could get, it's a real struggle for them to get to even 3-2-3. I think it's very hard to see now, ever since essentially the Tories and the SNP ruled out any kind of arrangement. It's very hard to see them getting past that.
Robert, do you agree?
I think I agree with Leo's analysis of the numbers. I think I don't necessarily agree about the mechanics of government formation that implies. A lot of it will depend on, in my view, does Labour have 285 seats and the Conservatives 284, in which case Miliband gets the first shot, or is it the other way around? I think if it's the other way round, I think it's much harder for the SNP to negotiate. They've kind of thrown away their real negotiating position by saying that they would rule out any kind of support for a Conservative government. I reckon if Cameron gets, say, two more seats than Ed Miliband and is given the first opportunity to form a government, he will fail. And that will either be done formally, and that he will just try and, you know, have a vote of confidence in the House and lose it, which I think is unlikely, or he will just tell the Queen that he doesn't think he can do it, and then Ed Miliband has 2 weeks in effect to try and form a government. But whether that needs even like informal support of the SNP, I think, is a moot point. In that situation, I think it's quite possible that Miliband and the Labour Party could, in a sense, call the SNP's bluff and say, either you abstain on this, you know, vote of confidence, in which case Labour could, without any formal support or with maybe a sort of a relatively simple kind of outline of what they would do as a government that might be able to command the support of Lib Dems and Greens, for the sake of argument, and maybe Plaid, could win a vote of confidence. And if the SNP chose to vote against it, then they would effectively be triggering an election. And I don't think it's in the SNP's interest to have another election. If they've just taken as many as 50 seats off Labour Party in Scotland and then effectively vote down the Labour Party's proposal to form a government in Westminster, I think it could be very tricky for them to be able to hold on to all of those gains in Scotland when the Scottish people are saying, well, we voted for the SNP and what we ended up with was another election. Actually, why don't we vote for a party that has set out a plan that we broadly agree with? You know, I think lots of the policy differences are fairly small. That, you know, in terms, you know, there's a different reason why people are voting SNP rather than necessarily lots of specific policy reasons. That actually that could cause Labour to gain those extra couple of seats. Similarly, if that dynamic was to play out in terms of the next few weeks of the campaign, and, you know, Labour have said quite clearly that they're not going to do any formal deal with the SNP, then I wonder if maybe that could erode some of the SNP support in Scotland and win Labour an extra couple of seats, which could be absolutely critical in forming the government.
I mean, all of that makes sense to me, and I think I agree with pretty much everything you said. But I think what I'm not clear about in what you're saying is how that in any way makes it easier for Cameron or makes it harder for Miliband. I mean, it seems to me that everything you've just said applies just as much, if not more so, to the Tories, particularly given what we know about how difficult it would be for the SNP to go back on what they've said and to do a deal with the Tories. Essentially, the maths seem to make it pretty much impossible, short of a significant change in the polling, for the Tories and the SNP to be able to get things through together.
But that can happen, can't it? We talk about we'll come on to it maybe a bit later in terms of what Cameron does next. But are we a bit hasty, presuming everything's over already? I mean, okay, the Conservatives are on, what, 302, I think it is at the moment. But it's still conceivable that when we look at some of these polls, particularly the telephone polls, which will be a subject of another podcast, actually, you know, the Conservatives are, in some cases, as high as six ahead, although that's probably an outlier. But, you know, they're consistently ahead of the phone polls, so why shouldn't they eke up a couple of points? Perhaps the polls understate the Conservative vote share a smidge. Before we go to the polling booth, and suddenly the Tories win by six, and actually they're sitting there on sort of 290, Labour's on something like 260. I'm throwing these figures out of thin air, but, you know, there's still a potential for them to form a government, isn't there?
Well, I think I agree with you up to a point, but as I understand it, when you start talking about 6 points, then perhaps it starts being possible for the Tories in terms of their lead. But firstly, That would have to be pretty shocking in terms of the difference between what the polls are saying at the moment, even the telephone polls, and the outcome for the Tories to end up 6 points ahead come election day. I think that would still represent a significant change in actual public opinion, not just the taking the phone polls as separate to the online polls. And one of the challenges for the Tories is that just being a few points higher than where they are now doesn't help them with the electoral maths, because that means they're taking seats off the Lib Dems, and that means that the Tories and the Lib Dem combined share doesn't get any higher until the Tories go quite a bit.
Because they need those Lib Dem seats
now
to actually form a government, don't
exactly.
they? I mean, let's talk about what's changed in the campaign, because I'm a bit confused here. I was under the impression that somehow there was going to be this Tory crossover. Ed Miliband's poll ratings are dire, and therefore when faced with the prospect of Prime Minister Ed Miliband, you know, people shy away from that. Maybe UKIP would collapse to, you know, some columnists say, you know, as low as sort of 6 or 7%. What's happened? I mean, you know, what's changed?
Well, I think to take those things in turn, the crossover hasn't yet happened. I think we saw that there were several opportunities that I think Conservative strategists were really hoping to have that breakthrough moment when they would turn the election from being, if you like, a referendum on the government, the coalition, and what they'd done in terms of the record, to being a referendum on Ed Miliband's leadership, that they would become an election about economic competence and who you trusted with, you know, the pound in your pockets, you know, kind of idea. You know, there were several moments, the budget being one, the launch of the Conservative manifesto last week being, I guess, another one, and certainly the debates being the one with regards to leadership being the question at stake. And I think on each one of those opportunities, we've seen that hasn't happened. That despite people thinking that Cameron did reasonably well in debates, you know, there being a broad sort of spectrum in terms of the outcome, which I think reflected the fact that it was basically a score draw, that, you know, nobody had a complete shocker, certainly in terms of, you know, Cameron Clegg and Miliband, but similarly nobody, you know, really broke through and made the whole election about, you know, in the way that Clegg had done in 2010, I think the budget was a bit of a wash. I think people had kind of, the story moved on quite quickly in terms of the media narrative from the budget, and we saw no sort of corresponding, you know, bump in the polls, which meant that the story went away very quickly. And then the Conservative manifesto launched last week, I think, has been overshadowed, not least by sort of other policy debates that are going on, where I think the media narrative is sort of turning to a situation where people are saying these things aren't happening, the crossover isn't happening, therefore, these other things are happening, whether it's a perceived personal attack on Miliband over defence, or whether it's throwing out the sort of affordable housing policy, which seems to have got fairly poor polling ratings, doesn't seem to have broken through with those kind of C2, you know, voters that are pretty important for building an electoral coalition that, you know, takes votes off Labour. So I think those opportunities haven't happened. And similarly, the other sort of trends that we were expecting to see haven't happened in terms of UKIP's vote has diminished a bit. But I think most commentators and most kind of voters seem to have got it sort of relatively priced in that, all right, so UKIP are not going to poll 20% and are not going to, you know, completely break through and come second in 200 seats or whatever it was that people might have been predicting after the European elections last year. But similarly, they're going to get enough votes. And actually, all of the party's energy and resources is focused on their getting out their core vote and winning Farage's seat.
The irony being that I think David Cameron might even be, or the people that think that UKIP are going to cost the Conservatives the election without actually achieving very much themselves could possibly be right. I mean, Leah, I'll turn to you. I mean, it seems to me that the Conservatives have completely, so far at least, hashed up this campaign. They're asking to finish a job without telling people why that benefits them. And as we know through the polling in this Parliament, the Tories have been pretty good at saying, you know, we're going to manage the economy better than Labour, but not very good at showing how it's going to benefit your lives. I suppose another great to get your thoughts on that. But another aspect is Ed Miliband, because I mean, it doesn't seem like this fear of Ed Miliband is particularly turning people off Labour. In fact, almost the opposite. His poll ratings appear to be improving. So get your thoughts on those points.
Well, the Tories have been saying for years what their election campaign was going to be. It was going to be chaos versus competence, and it was going to be attacks on Ed Miliband. And they've attempted to deliver on that, but it sort of feels that both of those aspects have backfired. So first, on the chaos competence point, what they seem to have done is relied on the expectation that people think that they are so competent that they can essentially say what they like during the election campaign, and they'll be able to ride on the reservoir of belief in their competence that they already had, so they can throw out unfunded spending commitments on the NHS, and people will continue to support them.
Which is the hope you said argument. I mean, they've sort of built up they've built up their capital, and now is the time to spend it.
Exactly, but it sort of feels a bit odd, particularly at a time where Labour are doing what perhaps they might have done sometime before, and really really push the competence angle. And there's an argument, and is it too late for them to build up credibility on that? It probably is, but with the Tories saying that this is about chaos versus competence, and the Tories themselves pushing out unfunded commitments, whilst Labour are saying, look how completely robust our numbers are, look at all these checks we're putting in place, it feels odd that this is how a campaign that the Tories have been telling us for years would play out in their favour seems to be almost going in the opposite direction.
But they had to promise something on the NHS, didn't they, just to interject there? Because I mean, if you believe the so-called grid, the next week's going to be a lot of kind of Labour talk on NHS and NHS commitments. But without the spending commitment on the NHS that the Conservatives have, they're naked going into that, aren't they?
Yeah, it's a fair point, and it was something they had to neutralise. It was in the same way the Tories were saying this is going to be a campaign about competence, Labour are saying this is going to be a campaign about the NHS, and they had to be ready for that. It seems surprising though that they've dealt with it in that way. On your second point though, on Ed Miliband, this is the other angle that seems perhaps more obviously perhaps to have backfired on the Tories. I think the single biggest change that we've seen during the campaign has been a real uptick in Miliband's numbers. I think it's still going on. I don't think there's any evidence yet that the increase has stopped. It seems that across all the pollsters, different extent depending on how the question's asked, but Miliband's approval rating, satisfaction with him and so on, however you ask the question, seems to be going up quite sharply. The interesting thing, though, is at the moment that seems like a voteless recovery for Miliband. His approval ratings are going up, not only among people who are already voting Labour, but among lots of people who are not yet voting Labour, and that doesn't seem to have made any difference. So a big increase in 2010 Lib Dem voters, who probably at this point are, I would say, the most important group for the election. There's not going to be Labour-Tory direct switching, the minor parties already being squeezed, as I think we'll talk about. But it seems that this big group of people who voted Lib Dem in 2010, who a lot of whom probably as half or even two-thirds are not going to vote Lib Dem this time, are the people who are up for grabs. A lot of them are not yet voting Labour, but their views of Ed Miliband seems to have increased a lot during the campaign. Mm. I don't know how that's going to play out, but I think it's interesting and potentially very positive for Labour.
Rob, I'll come to you. I mean, you do a lot of work with candidates, and you look at the different kind of sort of approval ratings that they may or may not have. I mean, one of the things I'm interested in is there's different ways of asking about approval of a candidate, isn't there? There's the kind of like individual aspect of it, where you might ask favourability or satisfaction or approval of an individual candidate, and that's very much in isolation. You're rating that particular person. And we do seem to have seen Ed Miliband's ratings tick up there. But there's also this kind of like horse race idea, as we call it in the industry, which is basically to choose which of several candidates would be the preferred prime minister or the preferred party leader and so on. So, I mean, what's your take on the differences there? Because my interpretation, and jump in if I'm wrong, is that Miliband's personal ratings are going up, as are some others, although his other story. But in terms of that horse race between Cameron and Miliband, Cameron still seems to have a relatively convincing lead there. So I just wondered, do you think one is more reliable than the other? One is more important than the other in terms of the election outcome? And what's your take on kind of the Miliband surge, if you like, in terms of his own ratings?
So I think, well, there's different ways of looking at this. I mean, I think rather than the horse race about leadership, which I think is quite a long, you know, it suits some media narratives to make that the kind of question about the election. I think my argument would be that what we're seeing is a kind of a post that people are choosing, in a sense, the movement that we've seen since 2010 has been people shifting party allegiance and then shifting their perception of the leaders. And I think part of that shift in the perception of the leaders is kind of people, maybe people started voting Labour, but they were still moaning about, you know, didn't like Miliband. Maybe some Labour voters, indeed, weren't necessarily happy that Miliband had won the leadership contest, but now it's getting closer to an election. They're saying, actually, you know, this is my leader, you know, the leader of the party that I most like, and actually I'm getting on with it, I'm dealing with it. And whether that's a movement from, you know, being unfavourable to being neutral or from neutral to being favourable, you've probably got a bit of both of those things going on. What I think is most interesting is actually the relative importance of the different aspects of leadership that get asked. And I think you probably have seen a bit of a shift there, because Miliband's often won on the question of, you know, cares for people like me, you know, shares my values, whereas Cameron has always won on things like, you know, being
the,
a strong...
the soft things.
Yeah, or on being a strong leader and, you know, maybe being competent or being, you know, articulate or whatever it is, you know, a good ambassador or, you know, statesman or those kind of things. Perhaps the nature of this campaign has been that those softer things are actually more important, that people were, you know, shifting from, you know, if they've shifted their allegiance from being a Liberal Democrat in 2010 to being a Labour in 2015, for the sake of argument, which we know a substantial proportion of people have, something like 25%, 30%, you know, of Lib Dem voters, you know, who've said for quite a consistent period of time that they're going to vote Labour. Perhaps for that group of people, sharing values and so on is just more important than being a statesman or being a leader on the world stage or being decisive or these kind of attributes which Cameron has been winning on. So I think that, and the nature of the campaign narrative, I think, has probably been to emphasise that. For the sake of argument, we have not, thankfully, had a particularly acute international crisis which has required, you know, or floods or something which has required acute disaster management, which would maybe throw some of those Cameron strengths into, you know, real relief in a way and shift that media narrative.
You've jinxed it now. Someone's going to experience some kind of crisis and it's all your fault.
Sure. But, you know,
what's interesting is the international story that's in the headline today as we're recording this is about the migrant boats drowning, and awful to even think about it in a how does this play out in a party politics way, but as an international story, it's probably something that attunes people more to the kind of values that Miliband has than the values that Cameron has.
Perhaps, yes.
But I suppose my point was not necessarily about the specifics, but, you know, the nature that we have seen campaigns in the past which have had a kind of acute crisis which, you know, would accentuate things. You know, people famously talk about the floods being extraordinarily good, inverted commas, for Gordon Brown when he'd taken over. It was an
Hurricane Sandy in the US doesn't have to be about...
it could be a positive or a negative for various different candidates, but certainly, you know, can accentuate some of those views or bring some candidate attributes into greater salience. And I think, you know, this is, you know, without wanting to sound too sort of horribly sort of West Wing about it, but I think, you know, that debate over which kind of media narrative and which kinds of questions are being posed by the election is really, really important. It's not a static game in terms of, and this is what we always talk about with parties and leaders when we're working with them on election campaigns, which is, you know, framing the election to your advantage. And I think, as Leo was saying earlier, the Tories picked a particular frame for this election which has not currently been working out to their advantage.
We've talked a bit about what's changed. Is there anything else? I mean, one of the big discussion points, briefly before we move on, before the campaign sort of kicked off, was around the breakdown of the two-party system, and that sort of leads us on to what the smaller parties are doing. We've talked a little bit about UKIP, haven't we? What about the Greens, though, Leo? Because, I mean, this was an episode that we did way back when, in 2014, but there was this Green surge, wasn't there? And, you know, Natalie Bennett's been on the podium in the debates. There's no Green surge. How many seats do you think they're going to get? What's going on with them?
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the stories that isn't really being told about the election, the dog that isn't barking, exactly as you say, 6 months ago, it looked like the Greens were going to be a major force in the election. Their numbers seemed to be going relentlessly upwards. That they stopped increasing for a while, and now gradually they're going downwards. I think it's
Locally, it's the same same factors as as the UKIP are facing. The major parties are squeezing them, saying to voters, a vote for those parties is a wasted vote. But I think more widely, it's a series of questions that the Greens need to be asking themselves. Their supporters like pointing out that unbranded. When you ask people how you think which party's policies they prefer without putting a party label on them, they generally really like Green policies. Green policies themselves are popular. At the same time, the Green Party brand is popular. People without thinking about policies say that they're more likely to vote Green than they are UKIP or the Lib Dems. So they've got a popular product as it is, a popular brand, but yet they seem to be doing really quite badly. They're doing far worse than other parties, Lib Dems and UKIP in particular, who've got less popular brands, less popular policies. And when you look at the seats in particular, the ones that 6 months ago we thought that the Greens would be really threatening Labour in, the student towns, liberal towns, seats like Cardiff Central, Cardiff North, Stroud, it looks now, the Ashcroft polling suggests that Labour are going to be winning pretty much all of those comfortably. The Bristol seats are a bit tighter, Bristol North West, Bristol West, Colne Valley as well. The Greens looking like they're more of a threat. But actually,
the threat is a spoiler rather than as to win the seats.
Yeah, probably. Bristol West is very hard to know because it's not been polled by Ashcroft. The Greens have been talking that for a long time. They're starting from an exceptionally low base. They've got a huge way to go. I think it'd be very surprising if they won that. And to be honest, that's the only seat that they can now gain. I think they'll almost certainly hold Brighton Pavilion. I think Bristol West looking like a surprise. I think the only seats where they are going to be of significance, really, other than those, are the marginals that were very close anyway. Places like Rossendale and Darwin, Southampton, Itchen, where a few hundred Green votes might well be enough to stop Labour winning. But in each of those, there's a much bigger UKIP vote. So I think if you looked at those, there's essentially no case for Labour to say, to win those seats, we need to be more liberal and to do more Green-friendly things. Because if you were looking at it purely from a numerical point of view, not about what policies you might prefer, but there's a far bigger, essentially illiberal UKIP vote probably in each of those seats than there are Green votes. So I suspect after the election, for all the talk of the Green surge, the party will look back at the results. They'll probably have the same number of seats. They'll probably have a higher vote share than they had last time, but they will have made essentially no difference to the election.
And probably have a new leader, maybe.
I suspect that would probably do them a lot of good.
We've talked about a lot of what's changed but in terms of the conventional wisdom going into the campaign. I mean, what hasn't? I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that, you know, Rob and I, we had the episode with John Curtis, didn't we, a few months ago, and we looked at the SNP surge. I mean, that has shown absolutely no sign of abating, Rob, has it? I mean, if anything, it's gone from strength to strength. I mean, I've written a piece recently for Matchbook.com looking at arguing that basically the SNP have arguably had the best campaign of any party. I mean, do you share that view? They're going from strength to strength, aren't they?
Yeah, and I mean, what'll be interesting is whether that does continue to election day. And I think, in a sense, I'm more interested in the way in which the SNP's role in the campaign and Sturgeon's role in the debates and so on. If that sustains itself, then the point there is it's genuinely having an effect on the national campaign. So we're seeing a lot of debate about what happens in, you know, we started this programme talking about what happens in a scenario with the SNP having, you know, 50-odd seats and so on. So that's an interesting dynamic that, you know, will that be sustained up until election day, or will actually you see either a slight unwinding in Scotland of the SNP support on the basis that they, you know, people are reading lots of press about, you know, the Tory press in England attacking, you know, the SNP, and, you know, actually they're saying, well, maybe this is a vote where we need to think about what's going to happen, Labour versus Conservative. I'm slightly sceptical about that having a huge effect, but, you know, if there's going to be any reversion to the mean, I would have thought that, you know, there might in a sense be a backfiring of the way in which the British press is writing up the sort of dynamic in Scotland. Similarly, you know, we're seeing, you know, SNP manifesto commitments being sort of more of the, you know, a bit more of the debate. The Tories tried to take advantage of that with the Trident issue. that's not really, you know, become a major election issue. I think it's fair to say that in terms of the British public's priorities, you know, discussion over whether or not we should be a multilateral or unilateral, you know, disarmament party or whatever is just not really part of the, you know, the narrative in the way that perhaps it was in 1983. I think that what's interesting there is the way in which the SNP, you know, will that SNP strength continue to affect the national election, and will that have a positive or a negative impact on, if you like, the Conservative Labour vote share? I think the other things which are interesting in terms of, you know, their sustainability has been, you know, UKIP. Actually, whilst the polling for UKIP is quite erratic, we've seen a small, a small squeeze there. But I think arguably the Conservatives have been less effective in squeezing the UKIP vote than Labour have been in terms of squeezing the Green vote. I think there's all sorts of reasons for that. One being that actually people that have decided to vote UKIP in a sense are going to stick with that. Their vote is more of an anti-politics and anti-politics as usual vote rather than an anti-Conservative vote perhaps. So therefore they're more likely to stick with it. Whereas people that were voting Green were like, you know, and hear this in focus groups, people saying, oh, I want to support the Greens, I want to keep Labour honest, but when it comes down to it, I will support, you know, Labour in this election. They might well vote Green in local elections, they might well have voted Green in the European elections, but if they know that their vote is, you know, if they know that their seat is close, there are fewer people who are, if you like, a plague on both the houses, I'm going to vote Green because that's what I believe in. And so I think, you know, there's a potential for Green vote to get further squeezed, as Leo is outlining, but for the UKIP vote to actually not get squeezed very much, and that's why UKIP aren't really bothering to focus on the national campaign. It's all for them, it's all about getting Farage elected, winning those seats in the Thames Estuary. If they pick up somewhere like Cleethorpes or Great Grimsby, you know, it's kind of a bonus, but they're not focusing their national campaign on that particular issue.
But also, I mean, when we look at UKIP, it's less overtly a Conservative sort of protest party than the Greens are taking votes from Labour, isn't it? I mean, we you know, there is this. I mean, I still feel that the UKIP is by far more damaging to the Conservatives, at least in the short term, than Labour. But actually, UKIP isn't taking all of its vote from the Conservatives.
And of course, a lot of those votes that are coming to UKIP from the Tories are people who in 2005 voted Labour and they look like Tory voters, but actually they're the people who were part of the Blairite coalition,
particularly in places like, you know, Cleethorpes or Great Grimsby, right?
Yeah. I mean, if we start thinking about what could change, I mean, the SNP comes to mind here, which is why I move on to this subject. There's some polling out from Comrades tonight. I haven't had a chance to study it in too much detail, but it does seem to suggest that there is some aversion in public opinion to the idea of the SNP being part of the government. I'll get your guys' thoughts on that. But also, this is going to be a dominant part of the campaign in the next sort of coming weeks, isn't it? I mean, isn't there a chance that David Cameron has a new enemy now? I mean, maybe his old enemy in terms of, you know, scaring people away from Ed Miliband hasn't really worked too well. But there is, he's going to have something in saying, if you vote for Labour or the SNP, you know, or you must vote Conservative, sorry, otherwise you're going to end up with this mess of a Labour SNP coalition, probably not, but arrangement, probably. Is there a chance that actually some, you know, English swing seats stay Conservative on the back of that?
Well, the Comrades poll certainly suggests that people are very averse to seeing the SNP in government. I'm a little dubious about it because I think it slightly overstates opposition to the SNP by using the wording something about which parties do you want in the coalition in a British government, and I think they're probably priming a slight
relative to others.
Yeah. I think it probably slightly primes an SNP opposition to the SNP with that wording, but I don't think it's a big deal. I think the point still stands. So it's clear. I think that there are a lot of English, I don't know about Welsh, certainly English voters who are anti SNP. How much that's going to mobilise their vote? Clearly the Tories think it is, and I think you're right, there's going to be a major part of their campaign. I think the anti-Miliband stuff has clearly not worked for them. Chaos versus competence is going to carry on being a major theme, I think, but the anti-SNP stuff seems like the obvious way for them to go. The polling suggests it's one of their strongest cards, but how much is it going to mobilise people? I'm generally dubious about any kind of electoral strategy that assumes a sort of inside baseball kind of interest on the part of voters, that they're really looking at stuff and thinking, well, if I vote for this party, it'll reduce chances of two other parties going into coalition. I don't know how much people really think about that, but I'm sure the Tories will try.
I mean, Rob, this probably presents quite a conundrum for the Conservatives in the last weeks of the campaign, doesn't it? Because, I mean, ultimately, I think campaigns are often quite a lot about tone. And either Cameron has to go sunshine wins the day, as he once did, occasionally does, and try and present a positive case for a Conservative government in the future, or he really has to hammer home this message of if you don't vote Conservative, then you're going to end up with the SNP in government. I mean, he's got a real challenge now. I mean, how do you think, without giving him too many tips, but how do you think he fights back?
Well, no, I agree with your analysis that it's difficult. I'm not convinced that banging on about the SNP and, you know, vote Miliband, get Sturgeon and so on is necessarily going to be a particularly useful tactic for him. I think if we go back to the sort of the frame of leadership being relative, or certainly leadership in the particular kind of style which would, you know, suggest that that's an important and successful line of attack, being relatively less important in this election, and something about values and the kinds of policies and the sort of nature of the parties and so on being more important. And if you think that the votes that Labour are gaining, which are going to tip them over the edge in a lot of these constituencies, are coming from 2010 Lib Dems, the idea that sort of attacking, you know, ratings of Sturgeon amongst Lib Dems and Labour people are actually, you know, depending on what questions you're asking, in terms of policy influence, are actually quite positive. You know, some of the things that the SNP are talking about, an end to austerity, being sort of liberal on these justice things, being pro-European, lots of these kind of things are kind of sotto voce issues, which some of those voters which are thinking about voting Labour in 2015 but weren't in Labour 2010 are actually quite positive. So, you know, I'm not suggesting for a second that this is like going to boost the number of, you know, votes that Labour get. But the idea that it's driving a huge wedge into Labour's coalition and is going to like peel off a bunch of people that voted, you know, in a particular way in 2010 and are going to revert back to that way in 2015 is just not really the strategy that they need.
But it isn't part of the point of it, actually, not about those people. It's about people who are considering UKIP. It's vote Tory or the crazy lefties are going to get and send all your money to Scotland.
It might well be, and I suppose for that reason, it might be a better wedge issue for them on that basis than, for the sake of argument, you know, going on about we're the only party that can really stop immigration, or the only party that are going to give you a referendum on Europe, or whatever the other kinds of classic lines of anti-UKIP squeeze would be. But I think we should see it through that lens rather than a kind of slightly more simplified lens, which would say Tories talk about vote Miliband, get SNP is in a message aimed at that group of voters that Leo describes, rather than an
even more complicated vote Farage, yeah, get Sturgeon.
Yeah, but the very complexity of that argument is one of the reasons why I don't think it necessarily will be that successful. And I think we were talking earlier about, you know, the UKIP vote holding up and holding up in the right places. I think there are probably just about enough, however you want to term them, spoilers or whatever else it is, to maybe, you know, gain Labour a few seats. Certainly far more UKIP potential spoilers than Green spoilers for Labour. And, you know, my prediction would be, you know, UKIP are going to pick up, for the sake of argument, 4 seats, maybe 5. You know, but I think that's kind of, that's certainly the maximum range of what they're going to pick up. I agree with Leo's analysis in terms of Greens. But, you know, there was certainly a time 6 months ago when we were talking about parties other than the big three in England and Wales, for the sake of argument, group them together, you know, picking up, you know, 50 seats, maybe, you know, 40 seats. Whereas actually it's going to look like maybe 10 at most if you put Plaid Cymru, the Greens and the UKIP combined
Labour Tory share is probably going to look pretty similar this election to how it's looked in most recent ones.
Certainly in England and Wales. Yeah. So, you know, taking the SNP
tools. I mean, Leo, I'd like to get your thoughts on what Cameron can possibly do. Obviously, he tends to stay in office. I mean, we haven't even talked about, actually, the fact that he has to get an EU referendum through Parliament to pretty much save his skin as well. But that's an aside. I mean, we talked about the UKIP voters. Is there any hope of there being some Labour supporters or current Labour supporters that David Cameron can win over? I mean, one of the things I try and say in the opinion polls is that just because you've got a group of Labour supporters, Labour voters in a poll today with YouGov or you know, ICM or Comrades or whoever, doesn't mean that these are dyed-in-the-wool activists. It just means that they happen to be Labour supporters. And there always has been a consistent number that aren't particularly impressed with Ed Miliband, for example. So, I mean, one of the hypotheses that I might speculate on is, are there some shy Tories in there?
Yeah, I think he's in an enormously difficult position. I think the moment the Tory SNP deal went off the table, it became hugely harder for him to win. But starting from that point, I think the grounds for optimism for him are very much Miliband, although his numbers are ticking up, is still much less popular than Cameron, and not just in the beauty pageant, but in terms of people thinking his ability to get the job done. And that includes, as you say, among a lot of people who say they're going to vote Labour. I think if I were a Tory strategist, I would be really pushing, continuing to push quite hard, perhaps not directly, perhaps using more proxies, but getting the message out to Labour voters. Do you really want Ed Miliband to be the Prime Minister? Because it seems like a lot of them are still not convinced about him. And I think there's a danger of us running away with ourselves, with our paying too much attention to the polling and thinking that his popularity is soaring. From conversations I've had in the last few days with people who are not such avid poll readers as I suspect all of us are, it seems to me that a lot of the things that we've been hearing for years about Miliband are still being said a lot. I've heard people saying he looks weird, people saying that his policies are a bit bonkers, he just doesn't really know what he's doing, that it's hard to imagine him in charge, that he'll be letting in the SNP. These are messages that are still resonating.
Cameron still has the opportunity in this final question time debate, which is it a week before, I think, the actual election? Is that right? I think that's right. To sort of frame the final sort of closing narrative as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it sort of seems that the campaign that the Tories were planning on running seems to me to be still the one that is most sensible and play most of their strengths, which is chaos versus competence. And do you really want to be letting in Ed Miliband? I think whether or not that's going to produce much movement, I'm not sure, but I'm struggling at this point to see what more they can be doing.
That was Polling Matters. My name is Kieran Pedley, and thanks again to my guests, Rob Vance and the prodigal son, Leo Barassi. Thanks, guys, for joining me.
Thank you.
It's been great.
The music you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under Creative Commons. And later this week, we'll be discussing the differences between phone polls and online polls and what we might want to look at there as the election approaches. Thanks very much. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.